From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. A little bit later on tonight, an attorney looks at ET visitations. Here's what's happening. Well, a story that was breaking last night while we were on, tsunami waves continuing now to ripple across the Pacific Ocean, sparking evacuations in Japan after a powerful magnitude 8.3 earthquake struck off the coast of Chile on Wednesday evening, generating a dangerous 15-foot tsunami along parts of the Chilean coast. At least 12 people have died as a result of the earthquake-related incidents, and officials continue to assess the damage as a number of aftershocks continue to rattle the South American country. As we predicted last night, the Federal Reserve has decided to hold interest rates steady and keep them at the same level since December of 2008. The Federal Reserve said 9 members of its Federal Open Market Committee voted to hold the key federal funds rate for now. Chuck Coppice, of course, businessman, marketeer himself, and president of the IDP Consulting Group. I kind of thought that they would hold the line on this, Chuck, but how long can it continue?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we've had, 84 months, like you just noted there, 7 years, and Japan has gone a full 25 years in this policy. That's what we're doing. And I think it's safe to say, George, that we're basically just trapped. The bankers have backed themselves into a corner, and there's no wiggle room. This is what the chief economist at the BIS said. He said there's no ammunition left. He said that in June of this year, and that's really where the Fed is at. We've had a tremendous slowdown for 8 months, transport indexes and so on, and obviously unemployment figures are fudged, and the Fed says that it has a dual mandate, and this has always bothered me, that it has a mandate for full employment, because that was added by Hubert Humphrey in the 70s, and that's just too much to ask of central planners.
There's some concern, too, that if the rates went up, it would hurt China, which could then have a worldwide ripple effect.
Yeah, there's been a tremendous global carry trade, and it's unwinding in the emerging markets, and China is one of them. That's part of the BRICS, so... not to mention the stocks here in the U.S. stock market has been driven by enormous amount of stock buybacks. In other words, they borrow at these very low interest rates, and it's creating an asset bubble, but it's really just inflating the stock prices and so on. And I think what we're really stuck in here is what some have demographically seen is a 35-year credit cycle since 1980, and that is what's coming to an end, and they're pushing on a string. That's the term the economists use to normalize rates. In fact, Ben Bernanke said at a private hedge fund meeting with hedge fund managers last year, rates will not normalize anytime during his lifetime. That was a quote by him.
Yeah, he's right.
So
a lot of people,
like the new normal to us.
Some people are predicting a major downturn in September, Chuck. Do you see any of that, any indication?
Yeah, and that would be, the bond market's a more accurate indicator of where the market's going, and they want to price that in. But, we've got negative yields in some countries in Europe and elsewhere. Are we going negative in the U.S.? It very well could be. And that's really a policy of financial repression. That's a term that I looked all day long to hear in the financial news and commentary, and nobody was mentioning the term financial repression. This is the official policy adopted since Japan to flatten the yields, the earnings, denying investors and savers a normal 5% interest rate on their investments, because they can't raise rates because we have $200 trillion in global bond and debt now. We can't service the debt. We're really trapped, George. I don't know where it goes from here, but I believe we're going to see QE4 and QE5 and so on.
Oh, boy. Chuck, thanks again. Chuck is also an author, America's Financial Reckoning Day. 14 years ago, a leading drug maker published a study showing that the antidepressant Paxil was safe and effective for teenagers. But major medical journals are now posting a new analysis of the same data, concluding the opposite is true. The study is a clear break from scientific custom and reflects a new era in scientific publishing, opening the way for journals to post multiple interpretations of the same experiment. It comes at a time of self-examination across science. Retractions are at an all-time high. Recent cases of fraud have shaken fields as diverse as anesthesia and political science. Earlier this month, researchers reported that less than half of a sample of psychology papers even hold up. The case of a 3-year-old girl here in the United States who developed type 2 diabetes, 3-year-old girl, has driven doctors to raise fresh concerns about the diet in childhood. The child had a version of the illness more commonly seen in older adults. A story at coasttocoastam.com under our hot stories. The hull of the first submarine in history to sink an enemy warship has been cleaned and revealed for the first time in 150 years. After a year of work, scientists using small chisels and hand tools have removed encrusted sand, sediment, and rust from the outside of the hand-cranked Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley. Remember that? They talked to us about that in school. It sank in 1864. All 8 of the crew members died, but not before that ship, with a powder charge, smashed into a Union ship off of South Carolina and took care of it. One of our stories in our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com has to do with the new pictures of Pluto. You have got to get up to the website and take a look at it. These new images have captured a fog-like haze, rugged mountains. It's amazing. And they're now beginning to think, is it possible that Pluto might harbor some kind of life there? It's a great story. There's another great story, Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. What kind of week have we had, Peter?
Well, it's been awfully busy, George, and I can't beat those photos from Pluto.
Oh,
those
my
are astonishing.
Gosh, yeah.
Boy, I've been watching them all day long. It's really exciting to see good science like that.
Yep.
I guess we're both going to be traveling this weekend. Tomorrow afternoon, I'll be in our favorite city, St. Louis, for my 50th high school reunion.
Oh, you're kidding. It's one of the few times I'm not there. I would have loved to have met you there.
Would have been fun to have a cup of coffee at the airport. And the next day I'll be up in Derry, New Hampshire. That was the third high school I attended. I'm afraid I won't be able to get to my second high school over in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, this year. But I'll be thinking about them anyway. Boy, a lot's going on. I think the UFO phenomenon is coming to a head, George. Last Saturday, the 12th of September, 2 p.m., to commemorate my presence in New Hampshire on Saturday of this week, a young couple was standing outside at 2 p.m. that Saturday afternoon and saw a very shiny, disc-shaped saucer object hovering in the daytime sky. They were astonished by what they were looking at. Suddenly, the objects just tended to descend a little bit. They said it appeared to be rotating, spinning on its axis, and suddenly it just disappeared from their sight. The next day, 10 p.m., the 13th of September, a group of people were equally astonished to see a V-shaped craft with very subtle red lights on the ventral surface of it streak over the city of Savannah, Georgia. They saw it for only 8 seconds, but that report is a good one, very well written, and it's now posted to our website. 2 days after that, Wenatchee, Washington, we've received about 3 or 4 reports from Wenatchee just in the last 48 hours. On the evening of the 16th, a gentleman was standing outside watching an aircraft fly across the sky from west to east. He noticed there was something behind it. At first, he thought it was the International Space Station. Then he realized it was the wrong time for that. And suddenly, the object turned blood red, just behind an airliner, George. So watch out the window when you're flying this weekend.
You got that right.
47 minutes later, he saw something equally astonishing, a boomerang-shaped object, again, embedded in red light, streaked across Wenatchee. And to close, 2 very brief sightings from the Los Angeles area tonight. The first one is from Yucca Valley. 2 young sisters saw a light shining at them, and it scared the daylights out of them, very similar to a report I gave last week about a sighting by 2 young fellows in Ashland, Oregon. These 2 young girls ran inside. They were so frightened. A few minutes later, A mother writes her son was witness to a glowing object that was being pursued by two jet fighters. Obviously, or clearly, military jet fighters were pursuing it. So there's a lot going on, and we just updated our website tonight with about 150 new reports, and people might enjoy reading them.
Okay, thank you, Peter. And in a couple hours, we've got an attorney who is devoting his career to investigating extraterrestrial visitations, and so you don't want to miss it. A couple of weeks ago, our nighttime producer and senior producer, Tom Danheiser, got very, very sick. As you know, we travel all over the country at various events when we tape our Beyond Belief television shows in Denver. And so there's a lot of flying there. But we're on the air, and Tom was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And he talked to me in my ear, as he has the ability to do that, and said, I got to go home. I just don't feel well. So he called Gina, and Gina showed up very quickly, thank God. And we both looked at Tom, and we said, you need to go to the hospital. And, Tom's like a guy, right? Most guys won't ask for directions. Most guys don't want to go to the hospital. But he decided to go. He's back now, but I wanted him to at least give you all an opportunity to hear him, because we had, and he had, hundreds, if not thousands, of emails from a lot of you sharing your concerns for him. Tom, go ahead.
May I never live that night again. And I'm thankful for the opportunity to be able to say thank you to so many people that I was blown away. They text me, they called me, they sent emails. I mean, people sent me poems. It's amazing.
Some even showed up at the hospital.
Yeah. Thank God, Christian Wild. People are amazing. This audience is amazing, and I'm so thankful.
You're still fighting a little bronchitis now, too, on top of the clot that you had in the lung.
The universe just whammed me in the last
couple
of weeks.
You know, I did a lot of research after we found out what was wrong with you, and everyone told me, medical professionals, that you could have died on the plane.
You know, I didn't realize how serious this was, but days into it, as I was reading and hearing things from people, I understood it was pretty serious.
Do you know what it would have been like to be sitting across from you while you had succumbed for an entire flight? Well, I mean, what do you do with somebody who dies on a plane?
Well, first of all, you call and they have oxygen, so.
Well, we do the best we can to keep you going, but I mean, if you died on a plane, where do you put the person? You can't just stop.
What do I say to that? I don't know. But I'm glad I did.
I'm glad you're feeling better, Tom.
Thanks.
In all seriousness, it was a scary time. Up next, we're going to be talking about hydrogen and power, alternative energy, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Mike Stritsky with us. Mike is the founder of the Hydrogen House Project, president of the Renewable Energy Holdings Company. He's also a world-renowned alternative energy inventor and developer of leading-edge energy systems. Now, during his tenure at the New Jersey Department of Transportation's Office of Technology, he developed the very first solar hydrogen fuel cell, variable message sign, and fuel cell vehicles, the Genesis and the Venture. In 2006, he converted his home to be off the grid using solar and hydrogen systems, making worldwide news. Back in 2010, he designed and built the Hydra, a solar hydrogen water and portable power trailer, and Mike holds several patents on the implementation of hydrogen systems and in solar system applications. Now, he's also best known for his pioneering work in hydrogen fuel cell systems, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Mike, pretty good background, and what a field to be in, huh?
Yeah, I never thought that the hydrogen economy would be here, but, you know, Toyota is rolling it out hard and heavy by releasing 5,500 patents free to the world, and I'm following on their coattails. The cost of the renewable has gotten so low that it now makes it feasible to have a hydrogen economy and to implement this technology everywhere in the world.
Where will we be 10 years from now with renewable energy?
Well, we're going to be in the same place that we were when we had cell phones. I mean, they're going to be all over the place, and they're going to be in everything that we touched that used to use fossil fuel. I mean, I currently have, you know, a cell phone charger that's a hydrogen fuel cell that I can take on an aircraft. Now, remember, you can't take bottled water on an airplane, but I can take a hydrogen fuel cell with 14 liters of hydrogen right through the check-in and use it on the plane.
How do you do that without the TSA guys getting all, you know, whoa?
Because it's on the TSA list of approved products.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yes.
And do many of them know that? I bet you have to point that out, don't you?
I do. And it's written right on the equipment
yeah.
that it's TSA approved. So, you know, fuel cells are going to cover every facet of our lives. And, you know, they're going to implement themselves as quickly as the cell phones did, you know, back in the 80s.
I've always believed, Mike, that if they could make money on this, we'd get it even quicker.
Well, we're at that point. You know, a lot of things are coming into reality that couldn't before because of the electronics, because of 3D laser printers, because of, you know, materials like graphene and Teflon and things like that. So what we couldn't do, even though we had the idea many years ago, like lasers and genetics, we now have the technology to do it affordable. I mean, no one ever thought they'd be able to afford a laptop computer, you know, or a home computer for that matter. And now we have more computing power in our iPhones than we ever had in the first six NASA missions.
How did you get involved in this?
Well, it was pretty interesting. When I worked for the New Jersey Department of Transportation, I worked in the Office of Technology, and it was my job to take space and military technology and find civilian and transportation applications. Back in 1996, I had a company called H-Power, who was building fuel cells for the military, walk in my front doors and say, "We've got this thing called a fuel cell. What can we do with it? Do you have an application we can put it in?" And we took a walk back into the maintenance yard, and we found these variable message signs that we had just gotten. They were solar powered, and they had something called LEDs, which were brand new. And the signs were going dead over the winter because the panels would get covered with snow, and we'd be chiseling these things out of snowbanks, and you know, the signs just didn't work. So we put together a pilot project to adapt it to the fuel cell to the variable message sign. We tested it for a year, and it worked. It worked terrific.
Perfect.
And the commissioner made the sign to do all of the signs. So we did 56 signs, and it became the world's first commercial purchase of fuel cells outside the U.S. space program for profit. And since then, it was just, you know, I was hooked. I knew that this technology worked, and you know, we were going to push this thing forward. The next 2 years, I built two fuel cell vehicles with the New Jersey Department of Transportation, which was the New Jersey Genesis and the New Jersey Venture, both made world headlines as the first fuel cell vehicle to ever enter a competition, and we won the Engineering Excellence Awards those years.
Mike, why has it taken so long to get to where we are now?
It's really the will to use it. It's disruptive technology. I mean, picture we're in a blockbuster world, and the digital media is out there. There are hundreds of millions of dollars that are invested in an infrastructure that run on fossil fuel, and that's what controls all the economies. You know, with this technology, we have the ability to do something we've never done in history, which is basically level all the economies, not have the ups and downs and, you know, the wars over oil and fight for natural resources. Because with my system, energy would basically be free. You'd be buying equipment. The big nuclear ball in the sky will provide us all the power we ever need to power these systems.
See, but that, I think, is the problem, Mike. I don't think they want us to have free systems, free energy.
Well, they don't, because they can control the people. He who controls the energy, the water, the food, and the communications rules the world.
That's right.
The difference between first world and third world countries.
Well, so how do we pull away from that? How do we convince those power brokers that we need to go to this kind of renewable energy source and systems? And yes, they're going to make money on the hardware, but I mean, how often will you be replacing it, right?
Yeah, I mean, the goal in all of this is to basically, you know, it's going to be a grassroots effort, you know, and it's going to be, you know, let my people go, you know, no longer be slaves. I've traveled all over the world, and I see how different societies are enslaved by the control of energy.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. I just don't know how we can break loose from these power barons who want to control us. We're going to come back and talk more with Mike Stritsky. It's an amazing story. The ability to have free energy. Can we ever get there? And welcome back, Mike Stritsky with us as we talk about alternative energy, specifically hydrogen. We'll get involved in that. So, Mike, tell us about the solar hydrogen home. How did you build it? And just describe it for us.
Well, the solar hydrogen home I've been living in for 9 years. I had gotten a grant and put up about $100,000 of my own money back in 2006 to build a house that would meet all the needs of the consumer and would be off-grid and energy independent. And over the last 9 years, I've refined the home to the point where it would be consumer readily for introduction into the code system and would be affordable as well. So I created a technology called the Joule Box, which is on my website. And basically what we've done is we've combined everything in the hydrogen house, which stretches out and covers a large footprint, into a very small footprint that fits on a pallet. So we have in this Joule Box, we have an electrolyzer that splits water into hydrogen and oxygen using solar power, takes that hydrogen without a compressor and compresses it into propane tanks, and then from there, it's stored as much as you want. You know, tanks are cheap. Once you make hydrogen, it's forever.
Great idea.
Yeah, it's as good today as it will be 100 million years from now.
And it powers the entire house.
Yes. Cooking gas, heating gas, and fuel for the vehicle. So anything you can do with fossil fuel, you can do with hydrogen. You know, when I first put up the house, a lot of people said, well, you know, it's too expensive, it's not practical. You know, no one has ever said it doesn't work. I mean, every manned mission since Apollo has used hydrogen fuel cells to provide the astronauts with their drinking water, heat, and electricity in the most hazardous environment known to man, which is outer space. You know, here on planet Earth, you know, it's used to back up the 911 system and telecoms. It's getting used right now to do power for forklifts, and now it's going to vehicles. And, you know, I'm carrying the infrastructure for all of these, which is going to be the home.
Now, when the power goes out because of storms or, God forbid, something happens to the power grid, in this particular case, the solar hydrogen that runs a house, what's the downside? Could anything happen to it?
Yeah, the nice thing about this system is, remember, where I live, we had Hurricane Sandy, Hurricane Irene,
yeah,
and a number of brutal winter storms that, you know, took out the power in the area anywhere from 6 days to 45 days, depending on where you lived. And my system was the only one that was operating after 6 days because all my neighbors were laughing at me when their generators ran out of propane after day six. They weren't laughing anymore, and they were at my house asking for the latest news, if they could charge their cell phones, you know, if they could get a hot shower. So they, you know, there were pictures here of Sandy of people waiting in lines protected by the National Guard with gas cans.
Oh, yeah. That was unbelievable.
So the thing is you have a generator, you're still screwed because, you know, when it runs out of fuel, you're done. And what's the first thing they do in an emergency? They shut off the electricity and the gas.
Yep, absolutely.
During Hurricane Sandy, the entire natural gas system got wiped out down the shore.
Were you the accommodating neighbor when they asked for help, I guess?
Yes, I opened up my house to all my neighbors.
Reminds me of The Shelter, that Twilight Zone show. He had a fallout shelter during the Cold War, and there was a warning that went off, and it sounded like the Soviets at the time had launched. And everybody in the neighborhood, Mike, is trying to get into this guy's fallout shelter in his house. And he wouldn't let them in. He only had enough provisions for himself and his family to last maybe a month or so. Who knows? But he couldn't let the neighborhood in. And that's how the whole Twilight Zone episode revolved around how people change and how they become violent and upset. And then Rod Serling, the genius he is, it was a false alarm. It wasn't a real launch. It was a test. And you could see the neighborhood folks walking back to their homes, and it just showed you the complexity of people. it probably would happen the same way. Those that have and those who have not, boy, if they knew that you had power, unlimited power practically, they would probably do whatever they could to get in, couldn't they?
They probably would, you know. Like I said, I share with my neighbors and, you know, and then they'll have to help protect what I've got.
How much would it cost right now to equip a house in today's dollars with some kind of system like this where it's self-contained?
Well, it depends on the amount of power that the house uses. The bottom of the scale would be about $40,000. You know, the top of the scale would be about $175,000, you know, for a very large home. But these systems also, you know, are covered with credits from the federal government. So it qualifies for a fuel cell credit as well as the ITC. So, you know, for the next couple of years, you know, Uncle Sam is paying 40% of your deal.
Well, okay, but let's look at the math for a second, though. Let's say you spend $100,000, right in the middle between the two numbers you just gave me. So $100,000 to get this free energy system running indefinitely in your house. Most people, let's say the average utility bill is $350 a month. That's 30 years right there, practically.
Yeah, the paybacks that we've worked out on this with the avoided electric cost, and, you know, you got to remember, in an emergency, people are going out and buying generators, and they're not expecting to get a payback, and they actually cost them money every month. This system actually at least has a payback. You're going to spend for a generator, you know, at least for a decent one, $25,000, and then you still got to put fuel and maintenance in it.
Right.
The ROI on the systems that we've designed are anywhere from 5 to 8 years. And the cost effectiveness is for people who have a minimum of about a $400 electric bill.
Can you get these things down to $20,000?
Yeah, as the volumes go up, the costs are going to drop dramatically.
That's that. If you could do that, then I think you really have a winner here.
Yeah, there are no technological barriers for what we do, and right now we're catering, you know, to the early adopters, same people who bought the big screen TVs or the first cell phones or laptops. But you know, we're going down a little deeper scale. I'd say we're probably at the mid level people with resources. We're not at the higher echelon, but we are, you know, we're on a range where we can get some pretty good volumes. And these things can also be done for communities as well. You know, so as the scale goes up, when we're starting to do whole off-grid communities, the cost will be less as well. And the nice thing about this technology is it's totally scalable. We can do everything from kilowatts all the way up to megawatts. And, you know, these things are being done pieces at a time all over the world, and, you know, it's going to happen quicker and quicker as technology advances every single year, you know, doubles and triples from the year before.
And every place would be self-contained, right?
Every place would be self-contained.
Now, what's the difference between the hydrogen power you use and the battery technology that Tesla wants to get into every house?
Well, the problem with batteries is from the minute you start them, they go bad. Every time you cycle that battery, it gets less and less
and less.
So eventually it's done and it becomes a disposal problem. In addition to that, to manufacture the battery, you leave scorched earth policy by digging up all these mines and destroying all this land. The Japanese learned from Fukushima that, you know, nuclear is not the way to go, and 60 years of recycling lead-acid batteries has decimated their soil, their water, and their air. And, you know, they basically, you know, broke their ties with Tesla to pursue fuel cells. And that's been the paradigm. You know, they also did the same thing with, you know, battery hybrids, and now they're picking the winner again. So, you know, even though the Tesla battery is, you know, more advanced than what we've had before, it still hasn't solved those problems with, you know, disposal, you know, with auto ignition, you know, with cost. So there's, you know, the battery technology's got quite a ways to go. There's only so many elements on the periodic table that you can use, and you know, we're down to the last few. And, you know, hydrogen has the least amount of drawbacks. It's 80% of every molecule in the universe. So it's readily available on this planet called water.
Yeah,
and people don't realize is you don't consume water in our system. It starts as water. It ends as water. You use the power of the sun to do the conversion. So there's no water consumed in this process. The only thing that's consumed is photons. I mean, think of a world that would, that the byproducts of your energy are pure water and pure oxygen. Think what that does to the health of all the people that are, you know, have childhood asthma from breathing in all the bad air.
I was going to say, I'd rather breathe in what you're emitting.
Yes. And like I said, everybody hits me with the safety aspect of this. You know, I would never have hydrogen in my house. Well, I'm carrying it on an airplane. In addition to that, you know, in this day of lawyers, if it wasn't safer than the fuels that we were already using, the automakers would not adopt this.
So we would.
We're having fuel cell vehicles go down the road at 80 miles an hour. They get parked in people's garages. You know, they can crash into bridge abutments, head-on collisions, whatever, and it's deemed safer, even by the Department of Energy, than anything else we're already using.
We're not going to have a Hindenburg in our house then, are we?
Right. And, you know, there were myths about the Hindenburg. You know, the whole skin of the airship was covered with aluminum oxide, which is rocket fuel. You know, any hydrogen that escaped went up in a tenth of a second or diffused in air so rapidly you couldn't chase it with a flame. And, you know, hydrogen only goes up. You're never going to get a hydrogen flame to go down, and it's never going to sit on the ground and accumulate like natural gas.
Right. Is that because of its weight?
It's lighter than air, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the reason they used it in the Hindenburg.
Well.
So, but the principles of hydrogen are very clear, and as long as it's handled safely, just like any other flammable gas, it poses less of a threat than the common gases that we already use.
What do these hydrogen cells, Mike, look like?
The hydrogen cells, they basically look like a stack of plates. In the middle of the plates, you have one side that separates, that has hydrogen going in. You have the other side of the plate that oxygen goes in. In the middle of the plate, there is a permeable gas diffusion layer and catalyst. So when it's in the presence of the catalyst, there's a chemical reaction that takes place similar to a battery. But unlike a battery, as long as you provide it with hydrogen, it continues to produce electricity. It never gets recharged.
What great technology. It really is. Now, are other countries jumping on board with this?
Other countries are jumping on board with this, and, you know, it's going to happen in places that, you know, don't have an infrastructure and are not married to, you know, to fossil fuels addicted like we are. I mean, the one thing that I see that, you know, like places in down in Texas can do is we need to start supplementing our fuels with renewables. For instance, you can take natural gas and you can add 20% hydrogen to it made from solar. And that's all free fuel that you can run in the gas lines and make no changes and burn just like you would burn regular, you know, the regular natural gas, only it burns cleaner.
It's almost like ethanol to gasoline.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to understand that all these fuels that we have are mostly hydrogen. Natural gas is CH4, so you're adding two more hydrogens to the mix. So you're really not changing
that's
a whole
true.
Lot.
That is absolutely true. Now, what do you have to do to convert things? I mean, for example, if you cook with a gas stove in your house, natural gas,
yes.
Can you still do that and use your natural gas, or would you convert that to hydrogen?
If you run hythane in it, nothing gets changed. You know, okay, so everything is the same. If you run on straight hydrogen, you have to change the burner and the pressure in order to adapt for hydrogen.
No big deal, I would guess, right?
Yeah. And it's no different than if you're running propane or natural gas. You have to modify the burners and the nozzle.
Same with your dryer if it's a natural gas dryer.
Dryer, hot water heater, but it's very simple. Think about this. You know, how many people die each year from having carbon monoxide poisoning from having problems with their furnaces or their hot water heaters?
Probably a lot, more than we think.
When you burn hydrogen, you get water.
Yeah.
So you don't have to vent it. You can use 100% of the heat in the house.
Worst that'll happen is you flood your basement, right?
Well, you'll get a little moisture in the air, but that's easily taken care of just by condensing it coming out of the burner.
Speaking of that, if you had a dehumidifier going on in your house,
mm-hmm.
and it converts the moisture in the air, obviously, and then you've got your water in the pan, can you drink that? Is that safe
yes.
to drink?
For the most part, yes.
Well, that's
you know, that water may want you may want to, you know, process it one time, but, you know, in a pinch or if you had to drink it, absolutely.
Or you could
A
cook
lot of
with it or
countries
something.
use what's called water makers, and that's what they are. They're basically dehumidifiers.
They should have a lot of those in California, for crying out loud. I don't know why they don't.
They are, but they're very, very power hungry. They should be recycling the water that comes out of all those air conditioners and, you know, at least using it for gray water and irrigation. You know, the water technology that we put together called the Hydra is perfect for recycling that water using advanced German technology called ultrafiltration. So, you know, there's some a lot of technologies out there right now that are game changers, and I think people just don't really know about yet.
We're with Mike Stritsky, his website, hydrogenhouseproject.org, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. What is your wish here, Mike? What would you like to accomplish?
I would like to give the gift of renewable energy free to the next generation. I want that to be my legacy. I want people to be, you know, freed where they can go about, you know, producing and doing other things rather than, you know, having to dig up the planet and polluting it and transporting it and fighting over it, you know, and I want to level the economies. I want to give people a better life. If, you know, I think that we should focus on getting off of this planet because we're going to consume ourselves into extinction if we don't. You know, all the peoples in the world should be looking at getting off and populating this big universe we live in and not consuming ourselves into extinction. So, you know, I've got a little bit bigger plans, but I think, you know, eventually it's all going to have to happen if we want to survive here.
I'm using these old television shows as examples, but one step beyond, a fellow invented some kind of little pill that you drop into a tank of water in a car, and it turned into gasoline. Well, apparently in that show, he was supposed to meet with Congress, and he never showed up. He disappeared. He was gone. They got him, I think. Are you concerned at all, Mike, that something could happen to you? I mean, this is pretty revolutionary, and you're stepping on a lot of toes that are making a lot of money on oil and other types of fuel systems.
Well, I mean, they're going to have to take Toyota out, and I don't think they're going to do that too easily. The technology that I'm using out there is known, you know, so I'm not coming up with that magic pill. All I'm using is stuff that's already out there, and I'm just getting the word out and showing how it can be done and leading by example.
Are you happy with the progress you're making?
I'm very happy with the progress I'm making, and I'm very happy with the world acceptance. I mean, Toyota actually brought a Mirai down to this dedication ceremony in an oil refining state here in New Jersey that, you know, they would normally not come to because we don't have a ZAM mandate. That's how strong, you know, they feel about getting this technology out there. And they know in order for the technology to succeed, it has to come home. Consumers have to be comfortable with it. They have to know it. I mean, when indoor plumbing came out, you know, it was you could drown in the bathtub. You know, when electricity came out, oh, you can get electrocuted. Look at the Tesla and Edison fight over how dangerous electricity was. And now it's in every facet of our lives. So it's an education process as well. And, you know, shows like yours are going to help get this the truth out there and dispel the myth.
Realistically, when can you start manufacturing to get these in homes if people wanted to buy it?
We're actually doing that now. We're taking orders from around the country and around the world, and we're producing the equipment.
How big's the whole unit if you had to just look at it? Size of what?
It's very visible on my website. It fits on a pallet. It's 3 feet by 4 feet, and it's expandable. I've designed the thing so it's microchannel architecture so that it can be expanded or contracted based on the need of the customer.
Inside or outside?
It's one platform.
If you put it inside or outside of the house?
It's outside of the house.
Okay, it's outside of the house. It's hooked in, and
And the biggest thing that I've done that I've accomplished that I'll be, you know, written in the history books for is I've been able to turn the code system around to where it will accept these kinds of installations. You know, my house took 3.5 years to get the original permits, and this home went through just under regular international building code permits with the local inspector.
Well, that's the way you got to do it.
In the most regulated state in the nation, which is New Jersey.
That's the way you got to do it. Let's take some calls with you, Mike, when we come back in just a moment. This is pretty neat, huh? Hydrogen power. We'll be back.